kind as to grab a seat. If you wouldn't be, then so be it. Keep chatting. Good to have you here this morning. Really good to see all of your faces. We have some folks visiting with us this morning, and so Branch people, be especially mindful, kind, hospitable, looking out for those folks. If you didn't know, we're in the series, The Adventure of Coming Home, and you know, if you want to go deeper, this is a book I've referenced a couple of times. Look, it's thin. It's accessible, and has been really meaningful for me. If you want to, again, take what we're talking about here on Sundays and begin to dive a little deeper, apply it to your life, this is The Gift of Being Yourself. David Benner is the author, and it might be worth having Amazon ship it to you in a couple days. All right. So who here has been on an adventure? Anybody? Yes, everyone should raise their hand. If you're breathing and alive in some way, shape, or form, you've been on some kind of adventure. Maybe moving to a new city, heading off to college, or starting a new school, or a new job, embarking on a dating relationship. You want to talk about adventures. Exploring parts of your faith you've never explored before. You know, if you've been on an adventure, that, you know, adventures always involve uncertainty and risk. Always. They're thrilling in the scary sort of sense, you know. They take us into uncharted waters. And again, that can be challenging. Add to that the fact that most adventures are not finished overnight. Perseverance, in other words, is required. In most adventures, you reach a moment where you think, I've had enough. I want to turn around. I want to go back to that old school, to my old neighborhood. This relationship is not worth the effort, right? And we think, I'm done. If you're going to see it through, it's going to take some time and some perseverance. But here's the reality. Any adventure worth going and embarking on leads to life. And so this idea of coming home involves all three of those things. Uncertainty and risk. Doesn't get finished overnight. If you are in this series with us and you're like, I'm tracking with the stuff you're talking about and I'm really interested in it, and in fact, I'm ready to take some steps in knowing God and knowing myself, and you're thinking that this is just going to work itself out in a few weeks, bursting the bubble, you know, sorry, like pop goes the balloon, I apologize, but this is going to take some time, but it's worth embarking on this adventure. Because it's in coming home that we find life. We find who we are meant to be. To help us get at this idea, we've been looking at one story from the scriptures this whole time. Sorry, not a lot of variety, but I think this story has that much depth to it. It's from Luke 15, 11 to 32, and it's the story of the prodigal sons. And I've been issuing a challenge the last couple of weeks to memorize this story. Some of you look at me with glazed eyes when I offer the challenge. It's fine. I'm going to keep challenging you. And I wonder, has anyone given this a shot? Has anyone been trying to memorize? We're like at the first 10 verses or so. Anybody? Oh, a couple people? No, you're not going to raise your hand. Here's the thing. I have a $25 gift card in my pocket. I told you I'd have an incentive. To the coffee shop up the road, they have ice cream. Does anyone want to come up here today and help me? Because I've been trying to do this too, and I know I don't have it totally nailed. Anybody want to come up here and help me try and get the first 10 verses out by memory? You're my son. I'll buy you ice cream anytime. And you're my son as well. Anybody? I saw a couple hands go up. Anyone? You're doing it with me, not even by yourself. No one? I will buy you ice cream. All right. Well, if you maybe have thought about trying, I'd invite you to keep thinking about it at least and to give it a shot. Even if you were to memorize a few verses, I think there's value in it. It would help this get into your heart, into your mind, into your soul a little bit deeper. The beautiful thing about memorizing this passage of Scripture is that it is a story. Stories are much easier to memorize than just picking something out of Romans. It's a story you probably at least know the major movements to. So you have these hooks that can be helpful. So here's how the story starts. We'll read the first 10 verses or so. There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So the father divided his property between them. Not long after that, the young son gathered together all he had and set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth on wild living. See, I need a little bit of help. After he had spent everything, a great famine took over that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said to himself, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, but here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against you and against heaven. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.'" So he got up and went back home. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and, filled with compassion, ran towards him, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. And the son said to him, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." Now, the reason that we're looking at this story over and over and over again is because it's really the human story. The story of the prodigal sons is really the human story. Because the sons in this story are tempted to believe that the life that they want, a life of happiness and fulfillment, is out there somewhere. We're tempted to believe that too. We're tempted to believe that the life we want, the things we want in life, are out there. Not here at home with God, but out there somewhere. In fact, this reminds me of a quote from a 12th century German theologian and mystic, Meister Eckhart. What a great name. He says, "God is at home. It is we who have gone out for a walk." We think that there's something out there for us that would be better than what we have with God at home. And so we head out on these journeys. We go out for a walk. We leave home because, I think we do need to be honest with ourselves. We're uncertain if God can really be trusted to secure our happiness. Think about that for a moment. We're uncertain if God can really be trusted to secure our happiness. And so in Luke 15, both sons leave home. One of them heads to a distant country, the younger son. The older son leaves home too, in a sense. I mean, he still lives at home, works at home. But when we encounter him in the story, when we gather what we can from his life, he's not at home, really. Physically, he's there, but that's about it. So they both go off, and what's interesting is that neither of them find what they're looking for. See, the life that we want, and there is a life that you want, there is a life that you know you are meant to have as someone made in the image of God. That life is at home, and it was all along. It's not out there somewhere. as tempted as we might be to think that it is. And so the adventure of coming home, as we've talked about, involves a journey inward, and it requires us to bring our whole selves. And this week, we're going to talk about how it includes unmasking our false self. Some of you may be well-versed in this idea of a false self. Have you heard, anybody heard of this thing before, false self, true self? Yeah, some of you have heard about it. Maybe some of you, again, are really fluent in this idea. You understand it. If you're like me, though, this is something I've quite recently, only quite recently, started to really understand and specifically understand for my life. And so, this is so important, I think, that we're spending a whole Sunday on it, and we even made these little half sheets of paper, which are places to fill in a bunch of blanks. If you're a blank filler-inner, and some of you are, you can admit it, you know, you love filling in blanks, this is your morning. And if you're not one of these people, it still might be worth jotting a note or two down and then taking this home. We're talking about the false self, and here's the first blank to fill in. The false self, what is it? It is the image of ourselves we want to portray to the world. It's the image of ourselves we want to portray to the world. You know, a metaphor that often gets used for the false self is a mask. A mask. It's what we want to show the world because we think it's what the world wants to see. And we're quite certain that if we take off the mask and we show who we really are, we won't be loved, we won't be accepted by other people and by God. And so David Benner, again in this book, says this. He says, at the core of the false self is a desire to preserve an image of ourself and a way of relating in the world that involves how we think about ourselves and how we want others to see us and think of us. We all create this image of who we want others to think we are. Do you think of it as a mask, if that's a helpful image? We put this on, hoping that if we show this image to the world, then we'll be liked, we'll be loved, we'll be accepted, we'll find success, all those sorts of things. So we wear this mask, we project this image. Let's just have a little bit of dialogue here. What kind of image does the younger son try and portray? What do we know about him that he's trying to kind of make known to the world through his actions and his words? What do we know about him? What would you say is his image, his false self, part of it?
Independent.
Very independent. That's excellent. What else?
Self-sufficient.
Self-sufficient, absolutely. Yep.
Free,
yes, along with that independence idea. Yep. Life of the party, yeah. Yeah, he would like to be, certainly. And he does become wealthy. Yep.
Prideful,
yeah. That's great. What's that?
Famous.
Oh, famous, maybe, yeah. Someone who gets the attention of other people. So that's great. Well done, well done. Those are fair, I think. Ways of looking at the younger son. What about the older one? What's that?
Jealous.
What's that?
Responsible.
Yes. That is the image he's portraying to the world. I'm a responsible person. What else? I work hard and I get a lot done and I always have. Yep. And obedient. I do what you tell me, Dad. I've never disobeyed you, he says.
Loyal,
yeah. I've never left home like that other son, right? I've been here the whole time. Oh, that's great. So those are great words to start to describe this image that the older son and the younger son are portraying to the world. And guess what? Just to be clear again, we all have an image that we try to portray to the world too. And that image begins to be formed early in our life. When we're just children, we begin to learn what others like about us. Kids, yes, you're figuring this out right now. You're gauging the world, and we all do this as we grow up. We try and figure out, What earns praise? What gets us acceptance? What do people pat us on the back for? What do people disapprove of or shame us over? And we begin to craft an image of ourselves that caters to those things. I remember when I was in fourth grade, my best friend was a University of Michigan fan. I mean, the family was blue-blooded through and through. And so guess what? I thought, hey, to be a friend of this guy, I'll become a University of Michigan fan. No problem. In fifth grade, we moved. My best friend in fifth grade was a Michigan State fan. And so guess what I did? In order to earn the friendship and be accepted, I became, when asked, what do you like? I said Michigan State, right? I wanted to portray an image of someone who would be accepted, who would be liked, who would be included. Maybe growing up, getting good grades was something that was stressed in your home. It's not a bad thing. Let's just say that was your environment. And let's say you got good grades growing up. Chances are probably pretty good. Then you told yourself that you were smart. And other people told you you were smart. And that affirmation developed part of the image of who you are. I'm a smart person. I'm industrious. I work hard. I get good grades. What if you grew up in that home, though, and you didn't get good grades? What did you then tell yourself? I'm not smart. I don't do well in school. And what did other people maybe tell you? Maybe the same thing. Maybe as a child you grew up in a family that didn't show its emotions. This is my story. You know, emotions were considered a sign of weakness. If you cried, you were told to toughen up. And so even though your true self felt things deeply, you didn't ever let those emotions show. You tried to cover them up in order to be accepted and liked. And on it goes. We're always, you know, we're still as adults and certainly as children, we're gauging the world and we're trying to create an image that we can project to the world that will earn us praise and respect and acceptance and inclusion. Okay? When I was 12, around that time, give or take, I was babysitting my brothers one night. I have three younger brothers. And babysitting in my home when I was a kid came with privileges and responsibilities. Privileges were that you got to stay up late until mom and dad came home, and you got to have a bowl of cereal. Now, this was the deal. Captain Crunch, a bowl of Captain Crunch, and all the other brothers didn't get to have it, and so you know, poor guys. Those were the privileges. The responsibilities, of course, you had to get everyone into bed, and you had to do the dishes. We didn't have a dishwasher, so you have to do the dishes. This was no problem to me. I was a hard worker. I didn't mind it at all. And so get the guys to bed, do the dishes, have Captain Crunch. Great night. Great night. My parents come home, and we're in the kitchen, and my dad grabs a sponge from the sink and says, You didn't clean this part back here. Hey, when you're doing the dishes, you know, do the job right. Do it the whole way. Don't halfway do it. Now, I don't think my dad meant anything by that. He wasn't being mean in that moment. It was kind of a teachable moment, I'm sure, in his view. And guess what? It taught me something. That perfection is valued. That you do a job the whole way and the right way. And so guess what is a part of me? A part of myself. Part of who I am. I'm a perfectionist. I work hard to do the job right. And that all didn't come, by the way, from that one moment in the back of the sink, right? Just to be clear. There are other reasons why I am that way, but it was reinforced that day. And this image of myself as an industrious perfectionist who worked hard and who did the job right became more and more part of me. And so even though my true self included imperfection, listen, I never showed it. I worked hard to portray an image of having my life all together. My imperfections, which are part of my true self, I did not let show. I only projected a false self, which was someone who was perfect, who did things right every time. If you're in this series with us and you're listening to this idea of the false self and you're thinking to yourself, I must be the only one who has a false self, please think again. Every human being in this room, including the children among us today, are creating an image of who we are in order to navigate the world. This is normal. This is part of the human journey. This is not to feel shame over, and I'll talk about that more in a little bit. So there's this idea that this false self, an image that we portray to the world, it begins to be formed early, and you know what? It works. Sort of. Consider the sons in this story from Luke 15. The younger son's image of this free to go wherever he wants, independent, can't be held in check rebel, that gets him what he wants. Did you notice that? He gets what he wants. The life he thought he wanted gets him freedom, gets him wealth, it gets him pleasure. It works. Sort of. Until it doesn't. How about the older son? He's a perfectionist, never making a mistake. That's part of his image because he thinks it will earn him affirmation and respect and praise. And you know what? In many ways, it does. It works until it doesn't. Again, neither of these sons get what they want, really, in the end. The image gets them what they want initially, but only for a time. The false self works. There's a reason why we all live out of our false self quite regularly. It's not by accident. It's that it's kind of effective often at getting us what we want or what we think we want. But it only works sort of. And that's because those parts that we hide still have influence over us. You know, we tell ourselves the lie that if we bury who we are, who we really are, if we never let anyone see it, then those parts of ourselves will just go away. And Benner says this again in the book, those parts of ourselves that operate out of sight and beyond awareness that we've pushed and buried away, they have increasing influence on our behavior. Dang it, you know? I think sometimes we are like two-year-olds, one-and-a-half-year-olds. Who's the developmental psychologist here among us? When do they develop object permanence, children, you know? Right, peekaboo. Peekaboo works because the child thinks you're not there, in part. It's also, or you take the thing that you're playing with and then you hide it real quick and they don't know where it went or they forget about it, right? I think we do the same thing with ourselves. We think, I'll just cover it up. And if I cover it up, I'll forget about it. It won't be there anymore. And the opposite is true. What we bury actually gains influence in our lives. I shared last week about a part of myself that I often want to hide. I want to hide incompetence. I don't want you to see the ways that I'm not good at something. I've been learning about this part of myself that's been outside of my awareness. It's been like not even in my consciousness. It's buried so deep. I've been learning about it. And one thing that I've been learning is that not only do I demand competency from myself, I demand it of those who are closest to me. Not most of you. You're close to me, but I'm talking about like the people who are closest to me. With most of you, actually, I have a lot of grace, most of you. Those of you who I don't, you know who you are. But, you know, most of you I do. A lot of patience, a lot of kindness, a lot of a lot of grace, really, honestly. What's so interesting, though, is that with my wife and my kids, not so much. I expect perfection and competency from them. One place this showed up is at mealtime. I have four children, if you don't know. Four children plus mealtime equals mess every time. That is a formula you can just count on, right? When my children would spill something, this is me just apologizing to you and to you and to you, JP, you know, when they would spill something when they were younger, I would get really upset. Let's just have it out, you know, here it is. Huh? And you know what I would tell myself? I would say, well, I get so upset because I really like things to be clean, and this is like the opposite of clean, and that's why I'm getting upset, because it's not clean, you know. And I would tell myself that over and over, because Bethany would be like, "What's? It's not a big deal, it's a cup of milk." I'd be like, I know it's not, you know, I know. But it's just because I like things clean. I've been understanding, though, as I've journeyed inward, that I did this because I'm obsessed with competency, with this image of perfection. And when my kids mess that up, when I've told them for the 10th time not to put their glass on the edge of the table and they do it anyway and it spills, that's incompetency to me, and it really bothers me. So you think, oh, I'm burying that part of myself so that it won't have influence over me. It will just kind of fade away into the distance. And in fact, it gains influence, and it shows up in ways that you aren't even like aware of at first. So this is one of the reasons why the false self falls short. It works, sort of. When we present this image of ourselves to the world, we feel like we are in control, and in fact, the things that we are burying and ignoring often control us. And this is a big, big deal, the false self sort of works because what started out as just an image of ourselves becomes our very identity. The image we create becomes who we are. The mask becomes permanently affixed to our face. And not only do other people see us this way, but we start to see ourselves this way. Think about the older son again for a moment. Obedient, loyal, responsible, sacrificing, flawless. That became more than an image that he tried to portray. It really became his identity. This is who he was, how he became to understand himself. He was the obedient son. That son over there was the disobedient son. He was the loyal, do what asked son. This was the one who squandered it all away on prostitutes, right? Now here's the thing. Was the older son obedient? Yeah, probably. Is that a bad thing? To be obedient? No. Was he responsible? Yeah. Pretty safe guess. He was actually a responsible person. Is being responsible bad, kids? Hear me now. No, it is not. You know, no. That wasn't the problem. The problem wasn't that he was responsible or obedient or loyal or any of those things. The problem is that those things became his entire image of himself. And he neglected and buried and ignored every other part of who he was. See, we start to obsess about this image, and we do everything we can to make sure that it is maintained. And so what's the answer here? What do we do in response to these realities about the false self? I would suggest to you that truth, not shame, is the answer. And that maybe begins by showing ourselves the same grace that God shows us. The truth about how God sees us. The older son, really, at the end of the story is remarkable. He goes off on his dad. I mean, just lets his dad have it. This image he's been working so hard to maintain, believing it would give him what he wanted, hasn't delivered on its promise, and so he, as it says in the text, became, or it says in the text, back in the text, he became angry and refused to go in. He became angry. This false self has not delivered on its promise, and so he refused to go in. So his father went out to meet him and pleaded with him and said, "My son, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours." This response is grace upon grace and kindness upon kindness. This son who's just gone off on a tirade deserves what? What do you think he deserves in this moment? If you were the parent, what would you give this son? Probably anything but grace. I would. And yet he has shown exactly that. And as I imagine the younger son coming around the bend towards home, shoulders sunk, head down, carrying so much shame over his past actions, what would you expect him to receive upon coming home? Not grace. We tell ourselves that if we let our whole selves be known by God, we won't be loved. We tell ourselves that the truth of the matter is that God won't accept us. God will shame us, punish us. That's the truth, we say. And yet shame never shows up in this story. Do you notice that? Shame is nowhere to be found in this story. Today, can you begin to show yourself the same grace that God shows you? That's one move to make. And the other, perhaps, is to respond by reclaiming our identity. Do you notice that the younger son is ready to abandon his identity? Do you notice that? His speech, we talked about this last week, he has a speech that he draws up while he's still off with the pigs. And he gets home and he starts delivering the speech. "Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm what? No longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants." That's how his speech goes. He doesn't even get to the last line, though. Why? Because the father interrupts him and says, "Quick! Don't delay. Now, immediately, get him the robe and the sandals and the ring." All three things that are symbols of this son's identity as a member of the family. The son is ready to settle for an identity less than the one that the father wants to give to him. He's ready to settle. "Just make me like a hired servant," he says. "What else can I expect? It's like the best I can hope for." And God says, "That's the best you can hope for? Quick, get the robe and the sandals and the ring." See, shame and regret would lead us to believe that our identity as a child of God has been lost. But this story tells us, it helps remind us that when we come home, we find that our identity has not been lost, hasn't been forfeited, thrown away. You were and are and always will be a child of God. and nothing you can do, no false image you can create, no shame, whatever you are bearing, none of it is going to stop or change your identity as a child of God. See, are you ready to come home today and reclaim who you are? Are you able to take a step towards that identity that Jesus proclaims over you? My son, my daughter, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. This is what God says to us. And so as we share this meal today, I want to invite you to consider that invitation. What does the Father prepare besides a robe, a ring, and sandals? He prepares a feast, gets a table ready, and says, come on in. Let's party. Let's celebrate who you are through me. And so today we come and we break bread and we drink from the cup. We gather around this table that God has prepared, and we are invited to remember who we are as God's children. We could be like the older son today if we want. We can stand on the outside of the house and refuse to go in. That is a choice before us. The other choice is to take a step across that threshold and come home.